So thanks so much for coming back and grabbing your seats. You know, as the folks meet, our elected leaders are meeting in Washington to figure out how to rescue and repair and sensibly regulate our financial services industry, it's easy to forget that much of the world does not have access to financial services at all, and that most in the developing world have never set foot in a bank or had the opportunity to build and protect and save their assets. So we have a remarkable lineup of speakers to address the whole question of how to provide the most sensible financial services for the poor so that they have those advantages. We're going to follow the usual format of a half-hour panel, half-hour discussion amongst you. Then the panel comes back and reacts to your questions and your themes, and then we will end with some commitments. But first, I want to be able to introduce somebody who I think absolutely the world of, and that's Sylvia Matthews-Burwell. Sylvia is a former colleague. Sylvia has worked in the private sector at McKinsey. She's worked in the public sector and in the Clinton administration, both in the White House and in the Department of Treasury, and she now works in the philanthropic sector where she is president of the Global Development Program at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has made a very substantial commitment to the question to providing for financial services for the poor. So I'm turning it to Sylvia.
Jane, thank you. Thank you. And thanks to everyone for joining our session this afternoon. As you can see, we have a terrific panel. And so I'll keep my opening remarks very brief. We're to discuss today strengthening livelihoods through financial services for the poor. And this is a priority issue for our global development program at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And the idea that right now 90% of those who live at $2 a day and under don't have any access to quality financial services. When you think that's 2.3 billion people, 90% of that, those numbers are astounding when you think that those folks don't have an ability to access savings, credit, insurance, an ability to move remittances if they would like to do that. If you think about what your life would be like as you tried to manage risk an opportunity without those tools, it's something that one thinks long and hard about. And the condition exists. Banks have a difficult time reaching folks in rural areas where many of these people are located, though we have two folks on our panel today representing organizations that are reaching those people. And additionally, traditional banking models have cost difficulties in terms of providing the services that the poor need, both in terms of size and things that they can afford. Tremendous progress has been made in microcredit, and we're going to hear about that. One of the anchors of that progress over many, many years is on our panel today. And that progress includes over 130 million people around the world with access to credit. And that access has shown that not only the poor have money and can bank and save and borrow and lend, but also that the poor actually are very good. Some of the premier organizations, microfinance organizations, have a 95% repayment rate. And for those in the banking industry and around would understand that's a terrific salute to the poor. So there's great possibilities. So today on the panel, what I'm hoping we're going to focus on, and then you all in your sessions at your table will focus on, will be what's the need? Why are financial services needed by the poor? What types of needs are there? What are solutions? What are the things that are actually working? And then the big question, how to scale? How do you really get scale in terms of these types of solutions? And I'll introduce the panelists as we go through with our limited time. And we're going to start this afternoon with Secretary Rubin. I think most folks in the room probably know Bob Rubin. Bob Rubin spent many years at Goldman Sachs before he then went on to become the first director of the National Economic Council for President Clinton, and from there went to the U.S. Treasury where he was Treasury Secretary, and then since that time has been with Citigroup in a number of positions, including chair last November, and is now senior counselor. Bob also has focused on domestic urban issues as well, and Citi, where he works now, has done a lot in terms of innovative ideas and services and providing for the poor, both domestically here in the U.S. They're doing some great things as well as internationally. And so with that, Bob, when we think about scaling financial services for the poor, one very important contextual point is the health of the financial system. And something that I know most people in this room would probably like to hear you speak about, so I'm going to try and help with that because actually Bob has has to leave, and he isn't leaving because when he isn't here on the stage, I don't want anyone to go out and move their 401k or something for fear. It's because he's actually meeting with the Vice Premier of China after this. So, but Bob, could you spend a few minutes on the markets and the economy, where you think things are and where they are going? Because it's very important context, I think, to the development of financial services access around the world.
Those are two questions, Sylvia. And the answer the same would be the same to both. I don't know. Sylvia and I worked together for a long time.
I could answer that.
Sylvia was my chief of staff. Well, no, that's not true. Sylvia was chief of staff at the National Economic Council when I went there, and then she was chief of staff at the Treasury. So our title, I was Secretary of the Treasury, was the title, and Sylvia was chief of staff. The reality was the reverse. So I'm accustomed to working for Sylvia and doing as she tells me to do. Look, let me try to do this in very brief, if I may. We're in a really an extraordinary situation. It is by far the most extraordinary situation that the U.S. capital markets have faced since the 1930s, though it's not the 1930s. They were multiples worse than this, but this is the most extraordinary situation. If you look back over the last 4 or 5 years, I think there was an increasing awareness amongst a lot of people that risk was being underweighted, assets were being overpriced. And that was widely remarked upon, and I think most people who saw that felt that sooner or later there would be a cyclical reaction to that on the downside, because that's how markets tend to work. But what happened instead was this really extraordinary phenomenon, a confluence of not only the cyclical overvaluation, which happens periodically, but also a host of other powerful factors, which when they came all together, created a perfect storm. Alan Greenspan has referred to it as a 1 in 100 kind of a phenomenon. I don't know if that is right or not, but I think what is right is it really has been, it is a perfect storm, and it is the most serious set of circumstances we faced since the 1930s. Looking forward, I break it into two pieces. Number one, we've got the immediate crisis, the crisis of confidence that really took hold just over the last, say, 2 weeks. And I think Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke are absolutely right in saying that the first priority is to stem that crisis of confidence. And some of you have lived through crises of confidence. Certainly you did in Mexico in 1995. We worked a lot with the Mexican government in those days, and we lived through it as well in the Asian financial crisis, 97, 98. And the question is, how do you stem the crisis of confidence? There is a proposal, as you know, before Congress being debated right now, $700 billion. We can have enormous debates if we want to about what the content of that program should be, whether it's optimal or non-optimal. I don't think that's really the issue at the moment. I think the issue at the moment is to put something in place that's responsive to this set of issues and that we think can make a really significant contribution to dealing with the crisis of confidence dimension of what we're facing. And I think in Paulson's proposal or whatever, or some reasonable variant of that that will be enacted by Congress, I think you have that. There are no guarantees in life, but I do think that what's being proposed could help significantly, and I think if it doesn't pass, then I think you greatly exacerbate the chances of this crisis of confidence becoming far worse. Once you get past the crisis of confidence, then you're back where we've been anyway for the last year, which is a set of short-term challenges to our credit markets. And I think there are a whole host of questions that relate to that and to working our way through it, and I think we actually were in some fair measure in the process of working our way through it before the problems that really, I said 2 weeks, it's really been longer than that because it began with the Bear Stearns situation, has increased since then and, of course, increased enormously over the last couple of weeks. So I think we need to work our way through that, Sylvia. And my own instinct was before this crisis of confidence began, and we were, but nevertheless we had very serious short-term issues, as you know, over the last year, that the highest probability was, the greatest probability was, by probably by quite some measure, that this was going to continue well into next year, perhaps even into the early part of the year after, who knows. But hopefully, although I did think then and still think that once we get past the crisis, conditions are going to remain difficult through that period. Hopefully, as you work your way through that period, at some point, conditions will begin to improve, and then gradually you'll have a gelling of the system. But there are very serious fundamentals to this that are going to take time and sound decisions, both in the public sector and the private sector, to address. Longer term, and whoever's got elected next to the presidency in this election seems to me is going to have to face both, and I'll wind up on this point, Sylvia, is going to have to face not only everything I've just described and act and be deeply engaged and act with deep thoughtfulness, but they're also going to have to engage with the long-term issues that our economy faces. And I think the United States economy for the longer term has enormous strength, with flexibility, its dynamism, that whole range of points. But we also face enormously who are usually consequential challenges, our fiscal imbalances, our many other imbalances, education, health care, equipping the poor to move into the economic mainstream, help for those who are dislocated by change, and so much else. So whoever the next president is going to be, it seems to me, is going to have to work on both tracks at the same time, address everything in the shorter term that I've just described, at the same time begin putting in place effective responses to these longer-term challenges. And if we do, then I think over the long term we can do very well, even in a rapidly transforming global economy.
Thank you very much for that context, Bob. Why don't we now turn to Fazel Abed, who many of you know, who is the founder and chairman of BRAC, which is one of the world's largest and most successful development organizations in the world. And I think at this point it's 110 million, maybe more by now, clients and people served in 9 different countries. It is one of the most successful models and approaches to development that has an underpinning in microcredit as part of its holistic approach to development at the individual level. And with that, as we were talking about the questions of need, solutions, and scale, you've addressed them all in the success of BRAC. And BRAC has been an incredible organization, both because you've had measurable impact for individuals as well as tremendous growth of your organization. And often people can do things in small ways, but not at the scale that you have been able to do it. Could you talk a little bit about what are the elements of success in terms of your ability to impact millions of lives in the way your model does, as well as your ability to have an organization that scales?
Well, microfinance, what we do when we started small. We try and make it effective, then you try and make it efficient, and then you expand. So that has been the model that BRAC followed. So wherever we went, we started small, and then we tried to become efficient. So the basic model is that in each village, you have a group of people, maybe 30, 40, 50 borrowers or group members, and then so you have an organization, a village organization. So they start savings and credit savings program, and then they among themselves decide who is going to receive what credit and what each of them is going to do with the money and so on. And so our field workers, our loan officers work with these groups in the villages that they operate. So one field officer will cover about 15 groups. 3 groups in a day they will cover. So approximately 500 group members to one loan officer will cover the borrowers. So savings and credit works well in the sense that you get poor people to save small sums of money. And so far we have been able to get about $200 million out of poor people in their savings, small savings. And this also provides the regularity that they bring in some amount of discipline in their approach to borrowing money, so they save regularly. And then also what we give them as loan is repaid in weekly installments, so they know exactly how much to that week they're going to repay. So it's all like clockwork. It happens. So you give somebody $100 as a loan, and you recover it in 45 equal installments with your interest of 12.5% or 15%, whatever you charge. So that seems to work quite well, and we have got 7.4 million borrowers in Bangladesh, and we have been expanding in Africa and Afghanistan, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and so on. So there seems to be not much of a problem in getting poor people to organize themselves to access to resources. But what the problem is, in Bangladesh, for example, we can take credit savings, but most MFIs, microfinance organizations, cannot take savings in most societies. In India, for example, you have to be a bank in order to mobilize savings. In Tanzania and Uganda, you have to be a bank in order to be a deposit-taking institution requires different kinds of a license. But as an MFI, you cannot take savings. So if you can't take savings, that means that you are having to borrow money in order to be able to provide loans. So that sort of certainly stymies the whole program. So in Bangladesh, we have been able to do it very well simply because we have been able to save, you know, collect savings and also borrow money from banks so that we could finance a fairly large program. But as I said, that there are something like 90% of the people in rural in Africa don't have any access to credit or savings. And I think what is needed is a structure, a kind of a routinized bank microfinance structure where you can access, you can go to villages, form groups, set up offices, have loan officers trained properly. So we have been able to do it in Africa. We went there about 2 years ago in Tanzania and Uganda. We've been very quickly able to recruit young people with high school education as loan officers, train them for about 2 weeks, and then deploy them with their supervisors and teach them in their as they are working. And we have been able to expand our program very quickly in Tanzania and Uganda, and also we have now gone into southern Sudan. And so I really don't see there is any great problem in knowing exactly how to go about doing microfinance. So microfinance is one area, but it's not the end of all the solution to the problems of poverty. Microfinance is, you start with that, but then there are a question of how much do they earn? Do they have a livelihood out of that? Or are they earning only as an insubstantial income to be able to, not to be able to meet the needs of the family? So you have to look at many other things apart from microfinance. So financial services is one area, so you start with that. But then I suppose you have to go to look at the productivity of the activities that they're doing. So low productivity, low income, and so on. So you look at how to improve the livelihood possibilities. So, for example, we have gone into livestock rearing, and then we find that many women in the villages can't market their milk because there's no market for milk in the village. So somebody has to collect this, take them to town, and then pasteurize it and sell them in the towns. So you have to also look at how to improve marketing of the products of the microfinance borrowers, whatever enterprise that they have invested money in. You have to also look at, I mean, we find that in Bangladesh we have about 500,000 of our borrowers who are doing vegetable gardening, but there's no good seeds. So we have gone into seed marketing business, seed multiplication and marketing, so that we could provide good seeds to women so that they could improve their income through vegetable gardening. So like that. So financial services is one, and this has a problem in the sense that not many, we have not been able to scale up programs to cover all the poor in the areas that we work in. And secondly, also, once we have succeeded in reaching the poor, we have not been able to also provide them a living income,
mm-hmm.
livelihood.
That's terrific. Thank you so much, because I think that highlights a number of issues, including the challenge, regulatory challenge around savings. I think that was one thing you highlighted that is a very real challenge in terms of expansion. Microcredit don't have to be a part of the banking system in any number of countries. As was highlighted, the savings is a big deal if you're not a commercial bank, and the regulations that follow from that. I want to remind everyone to please give your questions to your table person with the computer. I'm not sure the official table person title, but those people will raise their hands at your tables. That's how we'll get the questions for the panel after your session. So just want to remind you all to do all of that. As we're moving from this question of regulation and savings, our next panelist, James Mwangi, is head of Equity Bank. Equity Bank went from basically an underwater building and loan, I think it might be fair to say, some of the problems being suffered that Bob just talked about, took this institution and built it to be Africa's largest microfinance institution, and now it is a fully regulated commercial bank. We were discussing before we came out here, I was about to tell you that in Kenya they have 42% of all accounts. They now have 52%. 5% of all accounts in the country of Kenya, bank accounts in Kenya. Equity Bank is an organization that is focused also on serving the poor in the country of Kenya. And so they are able and making progress in scale and service of the poor. And James, I was hoping that you could spend a little time on a number of things. One of those being you've attended CGI before, and you were here last year, and you might want to say a little bit about what being here. I think that's an important part of what CGI is about. If you could say a bit about that and how that impacted your work. The other thing is innovation. You are terrific in this space and a quick mover and a first mover in terms of seeking to serve the poor as well as using different types of approaches to solve that cost problem of serving the poor. James.
Thank you very much. I think commenting on the Clinton Global Initiative, when I first attended, I was really inspired by the commitments people were taking. But I was not courageous enough to put my commitment on record. But I opted to go and try what others had tried. And amazingly, last year, we were here last year, September, we had 1.4 million depositors. And today, we have 2.8 million depositors. Got the courage to go and do. And for me, it's really, if all of us would be inspired like we were told in the morning, I think we could make a significant difference in the country. We have seen Equity contribute the number of, or the percentage of savers in the country from 9%. We are now above 18% of the population, and simply it's taking a bold step and doing what others have been able to do. Now, turning on innovations, Equity has been able to build the numbers. As today, like any other day, most likely, out of every 10 accounts that were opened in Kenya, 7 were opened in Equity. And then the other 45 banks shared the 3 that remained. And simply how we addressed to that was more, see what drives the lives of the poor people and try to remodel the bank to be able to respond directly to the drivers of the needs and livelihoods of the poor. Let's look at the savings, which we are very strong at. We are very strong at savings, not as good in credit like Ahmed here. But what we structured the savings product to be able to be more competitive than the traditional mattress banking. We ensured one, it didn't have any ledger fees on those accounts, was easy access, full liquidity, no restrictions on frequency or amount, and the ease of access using delivery channels made it as easy as it would be in the mattress. And then ensured the cost of saving is minimal. If you save 1,000 shillings in January, you still have your 1,000 shillings at the end of the year. And if you save at least 10,000, then you even have interest with no charges leveled on the savings account. So it was really drive that because they want a safe, secure place that doesn't deplete their small savings. In terms of delivery, what we've kept on trying to do is to try and take the bank to the people. And the tagline is take banking services to the people. It's not the people who come to the bank, it's the bank that moves to the people. And we pushed that using mobile vans. You just have a mobile van that goes from one village to the other, and with a solar panel on top of the roof, we are light on the tropics, on the equator, so the sunlight provides the power. And then a simple laptop as good as these are taking the banking software. And wherever you stop, you are able to serve the client online. And particularly the older people really appreciate that type of service. Today, with the support of CGAP and the Gates Foundation, we've been able to crack and make the cell phone or the nearest branch to a client where they can be able to transact 17 types of different transactions. And simply what it means is that Equity then doesn't need to build hefty costs of delivery channels in branch network. The cell phone is owned by the client. So, and two, you no longer need to employ staff. The client still do the operations of the account. And simply that is able. The last one, major innovation, is do add-ups like insurance. This year, we'll be able to do premiums of slightly above $20 million. And this is from small micro insurances, starting with things like health, going to funeral expenses, that which matters to the poor. They don't really want complicated things. And the last one is making banking very basic. Banking is all about intermediation, savings and lending, without any major complications being put on the bank. So basically, those are major innovations. And then the products that are appropriate. In Kenya, the majority of the population is engaged in agriculture, and we are very, very strong in agricultural products, including things like receipt warehousing. We saw, like, last year when the country went through turmoil. This year, it was saved by a program that Equity had done with the farmers, where it, using a receipt warehouse scheme, farmers could deliver. And since the National Cereals and Produce Board could not pay, Equity would discount the receipts. And this year, we perfected by saying, okay, the grains belongs to the farmer, not to the National Produce Board, and involved the private sector to do receipt warehousing. They kept the grains in January, when the prices were 800, and by August, when they were selling 2,400, almost three times what the price would have been if they sold. So it's that type of innovative product that makes Equity very attractive to the low-income segments of the population.
James, thank you. That's a terrific example of that taking advantage of opportunity through financial services in terms of affording farmers the ability not to sell at peak. That's a very important part of that. We're going to move now to Julio Frank, who was the Minister of Health in Mexico from 2000 to 2006. During his time there, he started the implementation of a very innovative approach, which was basically health care for all through health insurance in Mexico, and also oversaw a very innovative program that has to do with cash payments. He is currently serving and helping a number of foundations, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We're colleagues. And in January, though, we will lose him to become the head of public health at Harvard, a great place to lose him to, though we're sorry to do that. Julio, I thought you could help us all think a little more deeply about this question of need and the question of financial services for the poor in need. Why do people have needs, especially as it relates to health, which is a place that you spent a lot of time, though you spent much time across the development space, but maybe health and anything else you'd like to add in that space?
One thing we know is that every time you introduce financial services, whether you begin with savings or with loans, immediately the next thing that poor people will demand is some form of health insurance. It's the next big thing. And the reason is very easy to understand. This is the extreme form of insecurity for people. To live not knowing what will happen if your child or any family member will become sick, whether you will need to drive yourself into poverty even further because, you know, when it comes to illness, the price elasticity of demand just disappears. And people will go to the extremes of liquidating savings, liquidating productive assets even when it comes to poor people in the countryside just to be able to pay for medicines or for a doctor. This is a huge problem in the world. But what happens is that even though every one of us over our lifetime will surely have some kind of important disease, because that's human nature, at any given point in time, the number of people who are exposed to these extreme risks is relatively small. So there is a problem of invisibility of people who are suffering catastrophic payments. Every time you look into it, in every country, it's much larger than we thought it was. That's what happened in Mexico. We looked into the problem. Everyone thought we had a publicly funded system, and lo and behold, more than half of all payments were out-of-pocket payments, and there were about 4 million families every year that were being driven into poverty because they had to pay for their health care. Globally, the best estimates is that probably up to 500 million persons are exposed to the financial catastrophe because of health care costs. And this, to my mind, is an unacceptable paradox. Because if one thing we know in development is that one of the most powerful tools we have to to empower people to lift themselves out of poverty is improving health. And paradoxically, when countries don't have the social instruments for fair financing that spread the risk, then healthcare becomes a major cause of impoverishment through this kind of poverty shocks. And that's why we need this sort of innovative programs. What we did in Mexico was basically developed an insurance scheme for the self-employed. We had traditional insurance for those employed, where you have mechanisms that have been developed over centuries now. But all of those who work by their own, whether it's peasants or the small shopkeepers, were simply living in this extreme form of insecurity. And let me just mention two very quick things. I believe that most of these programs have to be grassroots. Our insurance program called Seguro Popular has extended. People were skeptical. People were saying the poor will not understand the concept of aggregating risk. It's not true. Actually, it's been the uptake has been marvelous. We had the challenge of insuring half of the population that was uninsured. So in order to achieve universal health insurance, we had to enroll 50 million persons. Half of the population. Mexico has about 100 million persons. We're now halfway through that. There's 25 million people right now that have this benefit and have a coverage that's pretty broad, including drugs, which is the main source of health expenditures among the poor. So it can be done. But it also has to be part of a nationally organized scheme. Because just local insurance means you create solidarity of the poor with the poor. And at some point, you need to bring this into a broader framework where the National Ministry of Health and the the public resources are actually subsidizing the demand of very poor people for quality services. And then it not only becomes a financial service, it also becomes a driver for transforming the entire health system. Because you shift the incentives, you put the power in the citizen to enroll in an insurance scheme, and you make that be the driver for allocating public funding for health. And that's what's happened in Mexico, a major shift in incentives accompanied with a number of structural reforms to assure that the providers are certified so that they can be part of the scheme. So you use the financial mechanism to actually improve the system. And once you have all of these marvelous programs you have, like in Equity or in BRAC, you have now the platform to add on this, which I believe is the next major service that people need to live in order to live with a modicum of security and really have the perspective that poverty is something that you can actually leave behind.
Julio, thank you. An important point for health in terms of that integration of the poor and health in the system. But as we think about financial services for the poor, thinking about that integration. So when you have the heads of ministers of finance in countries thinking about access across, not just sort of in their relationships with their businesses and that sort of thing, but access for all their people. And how do you create a concept that this is, when we talk about financial services, it's about making sure that there's access to capital for countries, as is President Sirleaf Johnson spoke about this morning, but also access for individuals. Bob, we're going to lose you, so we'll say thank you. Right now, Daniel Stone from America Speaks is going to come on stage and let us know what follows in terms of our table conversations, and what will follow after that. Bob, thank you very much, because we won't see you.
So we've been focusing this session about how to provide a range of financial services to people living in poverty. And we've heard from our panel a number of really extraordinary successes, as well as some very significant challenges in being able to provide these services, make them effective, and extend them. Clearly, there's more to be done. So we want to shift the conversation to you folks at your tables to have a conversation for the next 30 minutes. And the question we would like you to address at your table is, given the kinds of issues and given the kinds of challenges and needs that this panel has just explored with us here and any others that occur to you, what do you believe are 2 to 3 actions that should be taken by different sectors such as government, civil society, industry, others, in order to address these challenges? And what do you believe might be actions that could be taken by individuals such as yourselves who are in positions to make commitments about them to address these kinds of issues? You're going to have 30 minutes for this table discussion. I want to encourage you during this discussion, in order to make it as productive as possible, just to have a single conversation going on at your tables. And also, please make sure that there's space for everybody there to contribute to the conversation. Have a great 30 minutes, and your panel will be back.